December 1944, Hitler wages one last desperate attack.
It's really hard to believe, but it happened.
We had been surprised and were in trouble.
The bloodiest battle in American history.
They were like hugging each other and just shivering from scared. Never had seen such a thing before.
Because after you're in combat a while, dying is a lot easier than living.
Battle of the Bulge, tonight on American Experience.
Now in a montage, we see Joe DiMaggio at bat, a smiling Eleanor Roosevelt, Duke Ellington playing the piano, an Apache woman, Jacqueline Kennedy holding baby Caroline. More images. Civil War soldiers, Abraham Lincoln, troops stepping from a helicopter, Richard Nixon, caskets draped with flags. Exploding fireworks, laughing children, and Amelia Earhart with windblown hair. Words appear over cloth sewn with the stars and stripes. American Experience.
American Experience is made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of the role of technology. The foundation also seeks to portray the lives of the men and women engaged in scientific and technological pursuit.
At The Scotts Company, we help make gardens more beautiful, lawns greener, trees taller. If there's a better business to be in, please let us know.
Liberty Mutual Insurance is a proud supporter of the American Experience. And by helping people live safer, more secure lives, we're also proud supporters of the American Dream.
And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Now, an aerial view of gentle forested hills layered in fog. In a frost-covered clearing, leafless trees stand under a ghostly white sun.
Nature's not a friend, it's an adversary. And yet you must admire the beauty of it. And also you must admire the danger. It is so efficient as a danger.
A snowstorm cuts diagonally through the sky, outlining tree branches with a white veil.
Both the enemy and the weather could kill you. And the two of them together were a pretty deadly combination.
Now, black and white footage of a soldier crawling alongside a clipped barbed wire fence on a snow-packed field.
The snow was very, very heavy. The cold was down around zero. The fog was dense, so you really couldn't see much beyond grenade range.
A marching soldier, his coat and helmet encrusted with snow. Evergreen boughs sag with a thick snowy covering.
At night it was so quiet. Anything that made noise, you could hear it. The stillness and the snow sort of insulated everything. And then too, the trees were thick and you couldn't see very far. If you were lucky if you could see sometimes 20 or 30 feet.
Soldiers trudge down a path bordered by towering pines.
There's nothing out there in the woods and in the trees that have any compassion towards me.
It seems like that you're in this deadly struggle under miserable conditions and the whole universe is united against you.
In a bleak gray landscape of white fields and lines of leafless trees, a fiery orange sun dips below the tree-lined horizon. A red title appears on a black background, The Battle of the Bulge. Now, color footage of women throwing flowers to soldiers who ride past in a convoy of tanks, armored trucks, and jeeps.
In August of 1944, as American GIs swept into Paris, a gruesome winter campaign seemed unimaginable. Gene Derrickson of the 28th Division wrote home to his wife, "The roads we journey now, and we are traveling fast on foot, are littered with Nazi equipment burned and destroyed. Along the road, I've eaten blackberries, carrots, apples, and pears. Then a good night's sleep. Soft sleeping on flax.
American soldiers parade through the streets of Paris, past a crowd of women and men. Jeeps roll through the Arc de Triomphe.
4 months before the Battle of the Bulge, Derrickson and his division led the parade through Paris, past the reviewing stand where the brass stood. And where the brass stood was clear. Hitler was now on the run. Ike had a standing bet that the war would be done by Christmas.
To be present when this triumphal march took place was as though it was a reward for victories won and the enemy defeated. People were hugging and kissing and giving people things. It was a kind of a delirium.
A jovial police officer keeps back the pressing crowd. Women blow kisses, men wave and clap. A little blonde-haired girl blows a kiss.
The troops came down the Champs-Élysées and progressed to the Place de Concorde, and we alternated playing marches with the French band.
A young woman covers a GI's cheeks with red lipstick kisses.
There was just wall-to-wall people everywhere. And they were cheering and grabbing the soldiers and hugging them.
Boy, that was beautiful.
After 5 hard years of war, the Allies had won back Casablanca and Tripoli, Naples and Rome, Cherbourg and St. Lo. The list of victories seemed to grow each day.
28th Infantry Captain Ben Kimmelman.
It looked to us as though we had certainly turned a corner. We were now so triumphant, and this our show of strength and of moral position and moral strength was so astonishing, was so inspiring. It was very hard to be objective about it.
One afternoon, I was sitting having a glass of wine and watching our traffic stream.
Major Chet Hansen.
Just a steady procession of tanks, trucks, tank carriers, unbroken for hours, loaded with troops and everything under the sun. It was a feeling that, by golly, any nation that can produce all of these things, ship them all the way across the Atlantic, all the way across France, and chase the German, this was a country that could do anything. We had a grand ride right across France. We were not held up anywhere, and we went all the way on to the Siegfried Line. The German was running very, very hard.
Men and women stroll through crowded streets.
Once the Gestapo was ushered out of Paris, Allied staff officers and war correspondents reclaimed the bar at the Ritz. Restaurants reopened, fashion shows came back. Women could hope for silk stockings again. The War Department was shifting troops over to the Pacific. For the first time in years, U.S. production of tanks, ships, and ammunition was allowed to dip.
A soldier with a camera crouches down and takes a picture of his buddies. In a Jeep, 4 soldiers with machine guns tour through the streets. Now, footage of a Nazi rally full of young German soldiers standing at rigid attention. Second Lieutenant Oliver Patton.
From late October through November and early December, they were building up for this attack. Their production level reached its highest in the fall and winter of 1944. So how'd they do that? I'm talking about tanks, artillery, trucks, ammunition. They were cranking it out in these underground factories that had somehow evaded our Air Force.
The German counterattack was conceived and planned by one man, the Reichsfuhrer Adolf Hitler. Hitler was, by his own lights, a man of destiny. For him, Germany's suffering was merely a test of its will. He'd seen 4 million Germans killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. No matter, he would create a new army with a fancy name, the People's Infantry, the Volksgrenadier. What it was an army of cripples and convicts, children and grandfathers, but the Führer was in a state of euphoria. His Volksgrenadier would join the very best troops he had, the Waffen-SS, in a surprise attack in the West. Everything must be set aside for this, Hitler confided. It will lead to collapse and panic among Americans.
Hitler knew that something was wrong. Back in October, September, October, he knew that he was leaking. Orders that he gave were reaching the Allies. He thought he had spies in his staff, but he did the one thing that made it impossible to do anything with it, and that is shut up. Radio silence, in effect. And when it stopped coming, it just happened to stop coming in a period when we figured, well, there isn't anything to say. These guys are losers.
We had a preconception that they were unable to launch a counterattack, and they did everything they could to make us believe that. So you could say it was a case of self-delusion on our part.
101st Airborne Colonel H.W.O. Kennard.
Allied planes were bombing Berlin at will. The Russians were destroying the Wehrmacht in the east. There was speculation that Hitler was already dead. In fact, he had retreated to an underground bunker, cut off from even his highest commanders, poring over maps, planning his last great attack down to the smallest detail.
The Battle of the Bulge, the base of it really was an 80-mile front running from southern Belgium down to Edelbruck in the middle of Luxembourg, the Ardennes Forest here, between my thumb and forefinger. Hitler's concept was to attack on that 80-mile front, swing north, and seize the port of Antwerp. He was going to split the British and American forces and capture those people surrounded in here.
He points to Belgium.
Hitler's real target was the Alliance. There had to be frictions between the British and the Americans. If he could hit them hard enough and set them to quarreling, then he could negotiate a favorable peace. From October, Hitler started massing soldiers at the border. They didn't know why they were there, not even the commanders knew. One of the few who'd been told was Hasso von Manteuffel. The Prussian general went to the Ardennes front to take the measure of the U.S. division he was to attack.
Second Lieutenant Oliver Patton.
Now, the 28th of all of the four on the line was the most thinly spread, so thinly spread that literally during the day they outposted across the border into Germany. Become dark, they came back over the river. Von Manteuffel came down, got in the front line, watched this process, and said, hell, man, we don't need an hour's artillery preparation on these guys. The smart thing to do is walk through them while they're just getting up and having breakfast, because there are big gaps between these outposts, and we'll walk through them, and when we hit resistance, then we'll call in the artillery.
First Sergeant Roger Rutland.
We arrived there on December the 11th. We had been told that the division that was there before us had been there 5 to 6 weeks and had only had 2 casualties in that time. So we expected for it to be a quiet front.
We thought just what they told us. You are here on a quiet front to do patrols. You learn your trade. You get your feet wet. And it's not a situation of any great urgency. The 2nd Division, whom we replaced, the 2nd said to us, man, this is the ghost front. There's nothing out there.
Now, a thin, gray-haired woman.
We saw that something was going on. Lots of German military, everywhere, in the streets, but not on the main roads. There were machine guns, tanks, trucks, cannons. You can't name it all, but lots of equipment.
Marguerite Lindenmeyer was a Luxembourger who'd been picked up by a German patrol and taken behind enemy lines.
We did not give ourselves away as Luxembourgers. We posed as Germans from Bauer. They told us that if we possibly could, to get away, because something was about to happen. They didn't know when, but they said something is going to happen. Something is going to happen, for sure. Wir wollen nieder nach Paris, they said. We're on our way to Paris.
Lindenmeyer made her way back across the border to Luxembourg and reported what she'd seen to the American forces. Other civilians trickled in, bringing the same story. Intelligence officers passed the reports up the line of command and warned of a German buildup. The warnings were dismissed.
We did hear tanks moving, trucks moving, all sorts of noises indicative of the assembly of strength. And when we reported it, we were told from Corps, I think, certainly from Division, they're playing phonograph records. They know we're a green division, and they're just trying to put the scare on you. And I'm sure they had played phonograph records of tank movement before and gotten some results. These weren't phonograph records, they were tanks. But we accepted that because of our mindset that these people can't really launch a serious attack.
Now, a puppy with a wagging tail hops out of a Jeep and scurries around the legs of four GIs. Belgian flags, black, gold, and red, hang from buildings. Now, curator of the Nuts Museum of Bastogne, Guy Franzeron.
It was an atmosphere of jubilation. Every evening, in every village, in every town, there was a ball. Dances that were organized by the local population or by the Americans themselves.
A town square crowded with dancing couples and onlookers.
The best way to sum up that situation is this. Husbands were even proud to see their wives flirting with the Americans, who, believe me, did not hold back at all.
Women kissed the soldiers on both cheeks. The scene changes to a schoolyard. Happy soldiers watch little girls in white dresses parade out of the school. Shawnee Marks.
The word went round. The Americans are collecting all their rations to give a party for the children on December 6th, St. Nicholas Day.
Soldiers pass out sticks of gum and rolls of candy.
Mother Superior came into class to tell us about it, and that two of us could be his angels, and I was one of them.
The little angels hold St. Nicholas's billowing cape.
We were put into a Jeep and driven through the whole town. When we were ready to go home, St. Nicholas took each one of us angels in his lap and gave us a kiss.
The little girls wear white dresses, feathery wings, and starred halos. St. Nicholas wears a tall bishop's hat and carries a shepherd's crook. Now, German soldiers pick up their gear and march through a field. In addition to their rifles, most of them also carry Panzerfaust, 3-foot-long grenade launchers.
A quarter of a million Germans waited at the border. On December 16th, a Saturday, clouds and fog covered the valleys. It was the weather Hitler said he needed to keep the American bombers off his back. That day, a message went out to the 5th Panzer Army. Soldiers of the West Front, your great hour has arrived.
A commander hands out rifles. Captain Ben Kimmelman.
I was a division special troops dental officer, and I was stationed about 10 miles from the front in Wiltz, Luxembourg.
And Sergeant Paul Gifford was late, and I sort of was a wise guy, and I told him he's late, and he said, well, Captain, I'm sorry, but I lost my tank. And I said, boy, they're expensive as hell. You better go get that tank. He said, well, the Germans took it. I said, well, now you better go back and get that tank. I mean, you can't go losing a tank to the Germans. It's bad, bad business. So I got the usual laughter. And I said, what happened to Colonel so-and-so? He's going to give it to you. He said, he lost his artillery piece. I said, what's happening? He said, the Germans are pushing. Division headquarters, of which I was a part, was aware that there were now an increase in the artillery, enemy artillery fire and all that. But nothing terribly dramatic, except there was a hush that seemed that really and truly you could feel a hush, as though the civilians sensed what we didn't comprehend.
Norm Plum and Clyde Burkholder.
We were going to Edelbrook to play for the troops, and we began to see all these soldiers that they brought in there, GIs that were all banged up and wounded. So we went to inquire and see if what it had planned. And
there were so many wounded soldiers lying in this hospital. Well, they called off our performance because there was too many. It was the beginning of the bulge. We didn't know it at the time.
Yeah, that's right. That was the beginning.
The shells were flying all night long as we were trying to sleep. And when it came down the next morning, that was something else. He says, well, how'd you sleep? Not very good, you know.
Roger Rutland.
I went to bed, and the next morning at 6 o'clock, one of my messages came over to wake me, and he said, everything's popping loose. And I said, I told this man to all go on and leave me alone. I said, and then at that time, I heard the screaming Mimis start coming in, the artillery and all types of artillery. That was December the 16th. That was a very, very rough day.
Five German soldiers steady a firing artillery gun.
And by that night, the Germans were all over us, within 10, 15 yards right in front of us.
A soldier drives a burning Jeep.
If you could see a bunch of wild cattle running wild, that's what it reminded you of. I believe they were doped. I believe that the German soldiers were doped to a certain extent, because they were acting as if, I don't care if I get killed or not. They were like wild men. That's the best I can describe it of that first night.
I thought that my division had been hit by what we'd been taught in the fancy language of military academies and books as a spoiling attack.
Oliver Patton.
And that it just amounted to getting our act together and we'd throw them out. I certainly never believed that we'd been hit by a force that was really going to tear us up. Never.
A soldier aims a machine gun out of a shoulder-deep foxhole.
The men on the front line were hunkered in foxholes, cut off from each other. They had no idea they were being hit by one of the largest German artillery attacks of the war, or that they were outnumbered in some places by 10-1.
The soldier in the foxhole stares down his gun sight and smokes the stub of a cigarette. Now, a photo of dead soldiers sprawled on their backs around an artillery cannon with mud-caked wheels.
We lost many men that first day. An infantry company was approximately 200 men. A company was 21 men after the first day. C company could account for 59 men. And in my company, I only lost 28 men the first day. Every company commander was missing the first day except my company commander. It's really hard to believe, but it happened.
Across a field, an explosion flashes and rocks our view wildly. A building crumbles. Smoke and flames pour from a tank.
And some of my better men in garrison were some of the first ones to crack under combat conditions. They were like hugging each other and just shivering from scared. Never had seen such a thing before.
Now, a photo of generals at an elegant dinner table.
Dwight Eisenhower and Omar Bradley, the two most powerful commanders in Europe, got word of the attack on the 16th at Versailles. But the news had little impact that first day. Ike went to a reception to toast his orderly's new bride and his own promotion to five-star general. The British commander, Field Marshal Montgomery, was briefed while on the golf course.
Chet Hansen.
On the afternoon of the 16th, there was no real worry or concern about the severity of the attack. Those worries started on Sunday morning. And I remember General Bradley walking up into the war room that afternoon, looking at the map and said, where in the world has the son of a bitch gotten all of this stuff? He preceded that by saying, pardon my French. He was a very mild-mannered man in his speech. But yes, everyone was genuinely surprised by the force of the German attack at that point.
Ben Kimmelman.
By Monday, refugees were streaming down the streets with their household possessions, and their faces are absolutely grim, and there's no greeting of any kind. And you know that you're looking at a classic kind of thing, refugees before the enemy. And one of the first things I did was to go up to headquarters up the hill. And there it looked as though it was a recently disturbed anthill. People were running in all directions.
soldiers were running and all, at seemingly haphazard, jumping on vehicles that were taking off. At that time, there seemed to be nobody in charge. Nobody in charge. I saw one higher officer absolutely lose his wits, and he seemed to be trying to crank a Jeep. And there haven't been cranks on cars for a long time. He was just absolutely panic-stricken. And that disturbed me a lot. That shook me up.
Soldiers run down a street piled with bricks and rubble. Four men carry a stretcher and run. A Red Cross truck speeds past a burning building. In the countryside, soldiers slog through ankle-deep mud.
It was not an orderly retreat. We were just doing what we thought was best at that particular time. Primarily, we were backing up. We didn't really know where we were going, but it was primarily backing up.
Nothing was organized in the way of retreat.
Nothing was.
No, because we were too spread out and too confused to begin with.
Norm Plum and Clyde Burkholder made up the better part of the trombone section of the 28th Division Dance Band. Clyde was a 5'1" crooner with a voice reminiscent of Eddie Cantor, but with little talent for soldiering. He and Plum were part of the ad hoc assembly of rearguard troops now charged with engaging the Panzertruppen.
And they divided us up, the band with others, quartermaster, people from finance. A lot of them had weapons I didn't even know how to use properly.
Including the band.
Yeah, when they, in fact, I think some of the band I heard had a bazooka or somebody had one.
You gotta be kidding. We were lucky we could load a carbine, let alone a machine gun, and everybody standing.
Well, that's all we had is carbines.
Yeah, but I was thinking that when I brought the bullets there, and everybody kept saying, what are they for?
Soldiers creep through a thick forest from tree to tree.
Well, starting at noon, we went to hell in a handbasket. As soon as we got into the woods, we ran into Germans. And as we pushed forward, we ran into more and more Germans until by the time we got to the road that we were supposed to cut and go across, we were just backed up. It was a heavy firefight. There was a lot of fire. My platoon was just melting away. I went back and found the company first sergeant who said, there's an order for us to pull out, come back. And I, in the dusk, I saw a man and I yelled at him to, I'm sure fairly obscenely, to get his act out of there, that we were leaving, and he wasn't mine, he was a German, and he shot me. And I was put in the aid station, and I remember during the night, the chaplain came to me and said, Ollie, we gotta go. And we're gonna leave those of you who cannot walk in the aid station under the care of a medic, a soldier who's volunteered to look after you. And it dawned on me then that things had gotten serious, that you don't abandon, you don't leave your wounded, you get them out. And what he was telling me is we can't get you out.
On either the 18th or 19th, which would have been the third or fourth day, the senior colonel called back to division headquarters and said, we have no ammunition, because they only had 48 rounds per man to begin with. And that was gone after the 3 days. He called back to the division commander and said, we have no choice but to surrender.
Encircled and under artillery and even tank fire and many Germans on either side, the remnants were surrendered. We lost 2/3 of the infantry strength of the division on that day.
Germans lead tired and wounded Americans up a hill.
More than 4,000 men of the 106th were given up. Only the Americans' surrender at Bataan was larger. These men had been on the line 8 days, in combat for 3. Alan Jones, their general, was stunned. I've lost a division faster than any other commander in the U.S. Army.
Captain Ben Kimmelman.
After we surrendered, the German corporal took me forward, and then they put me on the hood of a car. I was sitting with my legs dangling over the grill, and he had a pistol to my head. And so we went up and down some hills, and I was like a trophy on the hood of this car with this pistol on my head. And to my absolute astonishment, I was looking at droves, at herds of
beautifully uniformed, young, healthy-looking, well-fed, well-equipped German troops. And my heart sank. God, they did it. I mean, they surprised us. They've got stores of people that we didn't know about. Wow. And they came by, these young, good-looking kids, laughing at me as a trophy. We had been surprised and were in trouble.
A subtitle reads, 2 days earlier. In a smoky nightclub, soldiers watch a dozen women dancing the can-can, kicking up their legs.
This is the G.I. Jive, man alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed.
Soldiers crowd around an officer as he hands out passes. In a hotel room, a soldier throws off his helmet and jumps into bed.
Rootle-de-toot, jump in your suit, make a salute.
Private Bob Dunning.
I had a friend, Herb Spence, and another friend, Jack Manley. Of course, we were real thrilled that we had a pass, you know, could get out like that. We got to Paris. Big city, unknown to us. We hadn't been there before, you know, or anything like that. And we were looking for a good time. And we didn't have any trouble finding girls and like that. And I remember staying in a hotel, a place called Place de Clisy, and a nice little hotel there. And they had plenty of supply of cognac and this sort of stuff, you know. So we would sit around and talk, and the girls would come in. And the particular girl that I had little short legs about so long, and I think she weighed probably, well, I guess in the neighborhood of 140 pounds, and she did a pretty good job with you when you were in the action, let's say, when you were in action, in combat. Let me put it that way.
A soldier with a lazy smile ogles a woman on a bicycle.
She was a country girl, and she would come in from the farm. I know Spence's girlfriend was a real model. Manley didn't care.
Colonel H.W.O. Kennard, Airborne.
We had men on leaves and passes in England, but we had lots of people in Paris. So we were thinking about everything except the fact that we might have to go back to combat. I was having a party in my quarters in Mormelon, and it was a good party because we were in the middle of the Champagne country there. And I went over to the headquarters where General McAuliffe informed me that he had just had a call that there had been a breakthrough in the Ardennes. He knew little more than that about it, but we were probably going to be moving out the following morning. Surprise would be, to put it very, very mildly, we were flabbergasted.
By the evening of the second day of battle, the Allied commanders understood the enormity of their situation. 25 German divisions were on the attack against only 4.5 U.S. divisions. Eisenhower and Bradley reached for the only reserves they had, the 82nd Airborne and the 101st. The 101st were paratroops. They'd led the way in Normandy and then Holland. They figured their next action would be the triumphal jump into Berlin.
Bob Dunning.
We were told by PA systems, you know, broadcasting, you would hear it. They'd come down the street and say, all airborne, and that meant everybody airborne, not only 101st, but anybody else. And it was to get back to your outfit, no questions asked, right now. And if you didn't, within so many hours, they'd pick you up and escort you back. And they told us to get everything ready to go, and we didn't know whether we were going to jump or what was going to go on. It was sort of a hang situation. So we just, when we got back to camp, then we found out. And, of course, we didn't really know until we got in the trucks and they said, you're headed for Bastogne. Well, where's Bastogne? You know, we weren't even sure where it was.
The main fight now was for 22-foot strips of pavement, the major roads, most of which ran through two towns, Saint-Vite in the north and Bastogne in the south. A quarter of a million Germans, plus tanks, jeeps, horses, and trucks, squeezed through the Ardennes. Generals stood on their staff cars for hours directing traffic. While the remains of the American front retreated, the Wehrmacht moved on to Saint-Vite and Bastogne at a crawl.
Well, we were told to move out and move into Bastogne. I mean, we were spread out on each side of the road right into a battle formation. all along the road, you would see dead guys, you know. You could hear the guns going off. You could hear the Germans firing. You could hear a little bit of small arms. And it sounded like it was, oh, maybe 2 or 3 miles away or kilometers away.
The scene at 18th Corps headquarters in Bastogne was one of semi-organized confusion. The Germans were at the gates, almost literally, and that the Corps headquarters was bugging out. We're moving to another location because they didn't want to be overrun.
I saw people coming back. They had a look of, well, I've been beaten, but I don't want to be. And a confused, glassy-eyed look. I mean, they were sort of dazed-like. And you'd ask them a question, what's happening? And they really couldn't tell us. They really couldn't tell us because they didn't know. It happened so fast. And then some of them were just plain scared. I mean, they were just, they'd had it. I mean, they didn't know what to do. I remember one young guy kind of jogging along and slogging along, and he'd no weapons or anything, and he was actually crying.
The 101st dug itself into the fields and forests around Bastogne. Its job was to hold the town.
German soldiers walk behind an armor-plated tank plowing through a cornfield.
To the far north, SS tankers had broken through. They were searching frantically for gas reserves. Americans kept a fragile grip on Saint-Vite, but in the soft middle, the Germans had split the line wide open.
German soldiers walk along a road crowded with abandoned and burning American jeeps and trucks. On the crest of a hill, a soldier gazes out at a countryside blanketed in snow. Combat engineers build an underground bunker as snow tumbles down around them.
On the 21st, the first day of snow, Bastogne was surrounded. Heavy clouds grounded the American bombers. C-47s loaded with supplies sat on runways, unable to reach the town.
Three soldiers wearing light jackets whitewash a supply truck.
We want what you call well repaired to go into a winter situation. I mean, we had a supply of normal combat fatigue type things, but that's about all we had. Gloves and things like that we didn't have. Footwear was mainly what we needed. We had combat boots that had the buckles on the side. We had those, and we needed something to cover them because we had worn those through Normandy and Holland, a lot of them, and they were worn pretty thin, see? Some of us had even cut holes in them for air where we'd impregnated those things with that gook we used to put on them to waterproof them, see? And your feet would sweat in those things, so we'd cut holes in those. Well, that was a stupid thing to do going into Bastogne because the snow would get in there and like that. We had limited ammunition, and that was one of the things, too, that we lacked was ammunition. We just didn't have time to get supplied full ammo.
Bastogne needed relief. General Patton's army was 100 miles to the south. George S. Patton had a sense of history and the will to make himself a place in it. He was already preparing his main chance, an attack that could propel him into Berlin. When he got wind of the German breakthrough, he feared Ike and Bradley were going to steal away his troops to plug holes in the Ardennes. But it didn't take him long to recognize an opportunity for glory. He told Ike he could pivot most of his attack force within 48 hours and sent word to Bastogne his army was on its way.
HWO Kennard.
On the 22nd of December, when we were totally surrounded, some German officers under a white flag of truce came into our glider regiment with a paper demanding our surrender and telling us all the bad things that would happen if we didn't. And we went in to General McAuliffe, who was taking a little much-needed nap at that point. And General McAuliffe mistakenly thought that this was some Germans who wanted to surrender to us. But we disabused him of that thought very quickly and said, no, they want us to surrender. And Tony McAuliffe then said, us surrender? Oh, nuts. And then he went on and he said, well, I wonder if we ought to answer them, and we all felt that it required an answer. And I spoke up and said, well, what you first said would be hard to beat. And Tony said, what do you mean? And I said, you said nuts. So he took a pencil and wrote to the German commander, nuts, exclamation point, A.C. McAuliffe commanding. When the surrender ultimatum was learned of, it was apparently a good morale booster for the American public. The American press every day was showing a picture of the Bulge with only Bastogne in the white, and all the rest of it was German, and we were still holding out, and that was about the only good news there was.
Curator of the Nuts Museum of Bastogne, Guy France Arand.
Bastogne n'avait strictement aucune importance.
The town of Bastogne had no military importance. The proof of it was in the plan of attack. There wasn't even a plan to take the town itself. The Germans got taken into the game. Once they saw Bastogne was becoming for America a symbol of resistance, then the Germans set out to destroy that symbol.
Between tattered, ramshackle houses, soldiers dig through the remains of a building. Dust rises like smoke from the shoveled-out rubble. Blanket-covered bodies litter a street corner strewn with wreckage and debris.
Hitler made it plain to his commanders, Bastogne must be taken. He released every spare man to the cause. German artillery flattened the town. Tanks and infantry attacked from every side.
A man climbs off a tank, his left leg shorn at the knee and smoldering.
There was no way to evacuate the American wounded. Medical supplies were used up. Doctors operated behind makeshift curtains. For anesthetic, they used cognac. This growing drama was not lost on Patton. He radioed ahead. He would crack through on Christmas Day.
Patton was a rather mercurial kind of a guy, very flashy. They used to say that he was the best ass kicker in the United States Army.
From his command post in Luxembourg City, Patton ordered his men to attack night and day. His army neared the southern flank of the Bulge at a gallop. But 2 days before Christmas, the weather upstaged him.
Bomber formations fly overhead. Now, a cockpit view of a fighter strafing bullets across a field. The fighter soars through a cloud of smoke and fire.
The weather cleared, and the planes could start flying again.
Soldiers smile at the sky, filled with fighter planes and bombers.
Planes were coming over by the hundreds. You'd see 36 in a group, 36 more, 36 more. And I don't know how many hundreds. And we just look up at the sky and say, thank goodness they are flying again.
And see those guys diving down and strafing. We knew they were hitting tanks. And that's what's keeping the crowds moving and keeping them busy. And this happened from daylight to dark.
Supplies parachute through the sky.
Hitler had gambled everything in the Ardennes. His best troops, his new reserves, hundreds of new tanks, and his meager supply of fuel. But he'd always known that wasn't enough. He'd also counted on bad weather. And after 7 days, his luck had run out.
Oliver Patton.
The German offensive stalled out.
The Allies held a northern shoulder.
In the south, the southern shoulder was held. The Germans were constricted to that 80-mile base. And driving toward Antwerp, they got no farther than just within sight of the Meuse River. Net effect was it died right there. That was the end of it.
A GI conducts a choir of soldiers and civilian women. Two soldiers place a small decorated Christmas tree on a wooden barrel. On the outskirts of town, two soldiers in a snowy foxhole eat dinner and drink from tin cups. In front of them, on a tripod, a Browning machine gun points down a tree-lined road. In town, two soldiers decorate a tree with tinsel and ornaments. Then they hang a few hand grenades by their round safety pins.
Patton's army got to Bastogne the day after Christmas, and they opened up enough of a hole for the press to squeeze through, along with the morale troops and the medal pinners. McAuliffe and the 101st were the pride of the American Army. But the price of an earlier pride was also on display. an army which had held itself unstoppable, had suffered 4,000 dead in the Bulge by Christmas. 30,000 more Americans had been wounded or taken prisoner.
Frozen bodies are loaded onto a truck.
The SS had executed hundreds of unarmed American prisoners, and in the town of Stavelo, more than 100 Belgian civilians.
Villagers line a trench with bodies. One carries a little frozen boy whose arms are outstretched like a stiff doll.
The Americans had given up a pocket of land 50 miles deep. It would take them a whole month to win it back.
Fresh troops wearing thick coats and gloves march through town. They have rifles slung over their shoulders and round, smooth, undented helmets. Nighttime. Pale moonlight illuminates the snowy fields.
Your imagination kind of runs away with you, I guess, especially when you hear noises. And of course, at night it was worse because you really didn't know what was happening.
We were very much afraid of the dark. We couldn't see the danger. And so as the light begins to come, it's beautiful. It provides you at least a view of what's going to happen. And you know what's going to happen in terms of the battle.
A newsreel title reads, Monty takes over as battle rages.
To meet the German drive, General Eisenhower here at Supreme Headquarters resourcefully regroups his forces, giving Field Marshal Montgomery complete command over the entire northern sector. With Britain's famous Monty cleverly holding Rundstedt back in the north, his American counterpart, General Bradley, blocks the Nazis in the south.
The first order of business, once the Germans had been stopped, was closing the hole in the American line where the 1st and 3rd armies were wedged apart. Eisenhower's plan was to join the two armies quickly and then push east. Patton wanted to make a bolder move, but Eisenhower held him back.
Patton wanted desperately to drive right back up the original line and be met by a counterattack from the north and thus bag all of the Germans who'd gotten themselves forward in the Bulge, so-called Bulge. He wanted to cut them off and bag this lot. I still don't understand exactly why the decision was made, but rather than trying to cut these people off in a bag, the decision was made to push them out. So in effect, reserves were committed from the south, from the north, and from here, and the American army simply stood up and slugged its way back toward the start line. Slow, dogged, costly advance.
In a fierce blizzard, a team of soldiers digs through the snow. Another team pounds fence posts into the ground. One GI, wearing thick leather mittens, strings barbed wire between the posts. The snow blurs through the air horizontally. Wearing a white covering over his helmet, a soldier with a bayonet-fixed rifle trudges through thick snow.
Both the enemy and the weather could kill you. If you were hit, you could go into shock, and in that temperature, you could freeze to death before they could get to you.
Soldiers unload a twisted, frozen corpse. Sergeant Jim Foster.
The first time I dug in, and I was digging that foxhole, and I threw my first shovel full of snow over, and I hit something, and I cleared the snow, and there laid a dead American soldier, froze, see. I mean, you say, that could have been me, and I'm here now. We're here. This is the real thing.
The Americans attacked into the worst European winter in memory. But Eisenhower maintained his good cheer. He was a man who lived by numbers, and he knew those were on his side. In the European theater, the Allies held a 10-to-1 advantage in tanks, 3-to-1 in aircraft, 2.5-to-1 in troops. Ike poured 500,000 men into the Ardennes. The Battle of the Bulge would become the biggest, costliest battle in U.S. history. For many young Americans, their introduction to the raw experience of war.
Our first attack, major offensive, was on January the 7th. We moved up under artillery fire to an attack position, and we were hit from behind. And actually, it was one of our own companies in our battalion had gotten a little bit offline, and in the confusion of that was going on at that time, they mistook us for the Germans and started firing at us from the rear.
Private Bart Hagerman.
After that was straightened out, then we began our attack on the woods, and then we came to a large open field. On the other side of the field was a large tank giving devastating fire into our ranks, and I think the Army turns it strategic withdrawal. But it really, we really just beat it out of there, and I was seeing people ahead of me falling and being hit, and so I went to down on my face, and I looked at right in front of me. There was a friend of mine that had I could see had been killed. We probably had in the neighborhood of 200 people in the company, and at the end of that day, I understand about 64 were present. It was a real turning point in our life, because I don't think any of us have ever been the same after that day.
Private Bob Conroy.
About midnight, I was sleeping. My buddy was on duty. And somehow or other, the Germans got within 20 yards of our position. Gordon got ripped by a machine gun from roughly the left thigh through the right waist. He then told me that he was hit through the stomach as well. Well, when you're that far from your home base and it's snowing and the temperature's zero, you don't have a chance. We were cut off. The Germans had overrun our position and we were in the foxhole by ourselves. So basically, we both knew he was going to die. We had no morphine. We couldn't ease it. And so I tried to knock him out. The took off his helmet, held his jaw up, and just whacked it as hard as I could, because he wanted to be put out. That didn't work, and so I hit him over the head with a helmet, and that didn't work. Nothing worked. He slowly froze to death, bled to death. The next morning, as we looked at our gear, it looked as if I'd spent a day in a butcher shop. My clothes were all covered with blood. His clothes were all covered with blood. The territory we were in was all covered. It was a butcher shop.
Now, three soldiers take up a position along a barbed wire fenced hillside. They fire as a fourth runs up and joins them. Two others crawl on the ground. Covered with snow, one looks around and motions to the other. Along the fence, a GI flinches at the sound of an explosion and curls around his rifle. A nearby soldier is hit.
The really hardest part of the fighting for the 101st was not during the time that we were on the defensive, even though we were surrounded. The most difficult fighting that we really had was when we were asked to go on the offensive. By this time, the Germans were on the defense, and they were trying their best to keep an opening so they could get their people out of the bulge and back to Germany.
The German generals knew their army was overextended and badly exposed. They wanted to pull their men quickly across the Rhine to the safety of the homeland. Hitler refused. On January 8th, he reluctantly allowed his men to inch back, but there would be no easy retreat. They were to fight as they went. The German army had fought through Russian winters. Its commanders understood winter warfare. They set up defensive positions on the high ground and in the warmth of the towns. The Americans lived out in the woods.
Most of the time we were in foxhole by ourselves. Occasionally we'd be with some, and we were foxholes probably scattered out anywhere from 30 to 50 yards apart. You had very little contact with anybody.
Well, the ground was frozen in the first place to such a depth that you could hardly get down the first 8 inches or so. It was just frozen like concrete, and you just had to chip it away. Consequently, we found ourselves using old foxholes, ones that had been, or slit trenches, that had been dug either by the enemy or by ourselves. Of course, if you were occupying enemy holes, they knew where they were, so there was a certain amount of risk either way you went. But once you got in, if you were there any period of time, and we usually weren't, you start trying to improve it by putting logs over the top of it to shield you from tree bursts of artillery.
German soldiers load 3-foot-long shells into a howitzer artillery gun. Its long barrel recoils fiercely.
They just shell us continuously. If you got out of your hole, you'd liable to get blown away.
5 German soldiers pass artillery shells up to a 6th, who loads it into the cannon. Sergeant Ed Stewart.
It's a screaming sound to the 88s, which was a major artillery on the part of the Germans. And the first is absolutely frightening. It's a nightmare. Eventually you get accustomed to it, you begin to make judgments about it. Is it coming in close, is it going to go far, or what? And you begin to be able to estimate pretty much where it's going to hit.
You can't fight back. Most people just kind of double up like that and hunker down, as they say, and hope that somebody else, not you, gets it.
2 soldiers lie in the snow and fire a bazooka.
The Americans were now on the attack. Each day, the men had to come out of their holes and advance into artillery fire. The Germans had superior guns and still plenty of them. Artillery accounted for 1/2 of all American casualties in the Bulge.
A soldier examines tangled, frozen bodies. Ed Stewart.
You had people killed in many different ways. And you would see hands around arms, bodies. You'd see a whole body there, horribly chopped up.
People didn't crumple and fall like they did in the Hollywood movies. They were tossed in the air, they were whipped around, they was hit to the ground hard, and their blood splattered everywhere, and a lot of people were standing close to people and found themselves covered in blood and flesh of their friends, and that's a pretty tough thing for anybody to handle, and we were no exception to that.
Medics work on a soldier with a blood-smeared face. Major Chet Hansen.
We had a staff meeting every morning on the operational situation, the intelligence situation, and always a manpower report on the casualties from the day before.
As the GIs crept forward in the Ardennes, their generals sifted reports from the front. They were grim. Patton's army, known for its speed, was covering less than a mile a day. The attack from the north was even slower. Ike remained 200 miles back at Versailles. The front was not his only worry. He was trying to keep the peace within his command.
There were severe strains during the Battle of the Bulge. Montgomery was perceived in the American Army as a rather arrogant, stubborn little fellow. I think General Bradley and others feared that if Monty ever got his hands on our army, he'd never let go.
For months, Monty had been badgering Eisenhower for control of the ground war. After the German breakthrough, Ike had reluctantly given him command of Bradley's troops in the north. But Monty wanted more. He demanded permanent control of all American ground troops. Ike was sick of the field marshal and threatened to have him fired. On the 9th of January, an angry Bradley made the dispute public. Hitler was delighted. This was just the fight he'd hoped for. It took a stirring speech by Winston Churchill to get the Allied generals back in line.
The war went along, and every day was like the day before. It was a 7-day-a-week job. It went on forever. For relaxation, General Bradley did algebra problems, and he worked at integral calculus when he was flying an airplane, or flying in his airplane. He said it relaxed him, made him think.
Private Bart Hagerman.
We were always thinking about food. We were always thinking about the cold and how to get warm or how to get dry. And we were always thinking about sleep. You were lucky if you got 2 or 3 hours sleep. And if the sun ever did come out, and it did finally during the latter part, it almost put you to sleep just immediately.
Private Bob Conroy.
You get extremely tired. When you're marching, carrying a pack, and you're going 10, 20 miles up toward the front, you're numb. You're tired. And you can go to sleep walking. It's been done. It's been done a lot. Except the road takes a turn, you go into the ditch.
Sergeant Ed Stewart.
It's very difficult to sleep if you're shivering with cold. One of the things that you would do, you lie down on your side, you bring your knees up, and you'd be paired with another guy who's facing you, so your knees would go into his stomach, and your head around his head. You have two people in the womb position taking advantage of that position to preserve body heat and life. Another way of doing it to keep you off the snow is you take three men, and you put your arms around each other's shoulder. So that you got three bodies, if you will, propping each other up. And then you lower your head, and you go off to sleep, standing up. You never really went off into a deep sleep, sort of half awake, half asleep.
Dead and sleeping soldiers in a roadside ditch.
I would go to sleep at night, and my feet would get cold, and I would wake up, and they were numb, and I'd start kicking them together and get circulation started again, and I was good maybe for another hour or so.
Sergeant Roger Rutland.
I had frozen toes. My big toes were as big as much bigger than a golf ball. And I had many men that I had to send back and that had feet amputated at the ankles. Some of them would just lose the toes.
Halfway through the Battle of the Bulge, the Army was still waiting for its main shipment of winter boots. Men suffering from frozen feet were given whiskey or distilled alcohol to drink, which only made things worse. Some 15,000 soldiers were taken off the line with frostbite.
Jim Foster.
We went out at dark, as close to the German lines as we could get, and I was to report back to Lieutenant Clausen and report what we'd seen or heard that night. So I went back to the house and told Lieutenant Clausen we didn't hear or see anything. He called, my name was Porkchops in the Army, and he said, Porkchops, you go ahead and lay down here and go to sleep, and I'll wake you when I need you. So this was like 7 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't wake up about 12 o'clock at night. And when I woke up, I almost instantly noticed there was something wrong with my feet, and they'd swollen up about a third bigger than they were, you know, and hurt then. And within 3 days, I was back in England in a hospital.
I saw people that are being evacuated with frozen feet, and their feet were just as black as coal, kind of maybe a gun steel blue, if you want to put it that way. And in the first stages, they swell quite a bit. But then after that, when they start turning blue and everything, they get almost flat. Kind of turns your stomach, I guess. It was a bad sight.
If you didn't get circulation back within X number of days, I can't remember, 4 or 5 days, then there was a good possibility the gangrene was setting in or had set in. And if you went another 3 or 4 days and you didn't start getting feeling, they amputated feet. And I do know there was one boy just about 3 bunks from me. He'd been there a few days before. And when they informed him that he was going to have his left foot removed, I remember that boy like went crazy.
Chet Hansen.
People do get hurt. People get wounded. People die in war. And there always had to be a stream of replacements coming in, particularly for the rifle companies. It was a critical situation, and we were not getting the replacements that we needed.
Infantrymen made up only 10% of the total American army, but they took 70% of the casualties. Eisenhower was anxiously combing out the rear echelons, looking for men. He didn't need more fancy hardware. In this weather, a lot of it didn't even work. The high command understood. There was only one way to take ground.
the key to the fighting ability of a force is the guy who picks up a rifle, the infantryman, and there aren't that many infantrymen in a division. There are only about 3,200 infantrymen who pick up their rifles and go forward.
From Normandy to Bastogne, I would guess probably our rate of casualties and this type of thing, I have heard the figures of anywhere from 250 to 300%. And that seems a little fantastic because we had a terrific amount of turnover in this type of thing. You'd be there one day and you'd have all new guys the next day.
The arithmetic was simple. The Army had been losing 2,000 men a day for almost a month. New men had to be found to take their place. Physical standards were lowered, training cut short. Many of the recruits were just out of high school. They were ill-prepared and little encouraged. As one assigning officer was fond of telling them, most of you aren't coming back. Just as well get used to it now.
They were suddenly loaded into trucks by the numbers and sent off to a division somewhere. And particularly in the Battle of the Bulge, we had men who were sent in as replacements, joining a unit. Sergeants never even got to know their names before they were wounded or killed the next day.
We really didn't get to know them. We just kind of tolerated them, so to speak. And as I look back on it now, I realize that we probably treated them pretty shabbily. And I feel sorry for them. A lot of them were killed and we never even knew who they were. Somebody said, we got a couple of casualties. Who are you? Who were they? And they said, oh, a couple of new guys. I don't know what their names are. Somebody had to check dog tags to find out who they were.
Medics crouch in the snow and read dead soldiers' dog tags.
On January the 13th, we were almost to this little town of Cooley, and the artillery started coming in. I had at least 15 of my new men that I knew the names on paper, but I hadn't put the name and the face together yet, because I only had them a week or 10 days. And about 15 of those men were killed just like that, in a period of 10 minutes or less.
An artillery blast blows a bridge sky high. Four GIs lie in a foxhole and poke their rifles over the top.
The Americans were taking back the Ardennes one small town at a time. First, gunners blanketed the towns with artillery. Then the ground soldiers came out of the woods on foot and in tanks, shooting as they went. When GIs fought their way into a town, the civilians were never in sight.
On menait une vie dans les caves.
Joseph Scheer.
On essayait de vivre là.
We lived our lives in the cellars. You tried to live there with the means you had, with what you could get to eat. I remember that the water mains had been destroyed. There was no water, so I remember my father went out. It was winter. Everything was frozen, and he brought back the snow, and people melted it to drink it. And this water was black, black from gunpowder, from all the shells exploding in the area.
While civilians prayed in their basements, their towns were falling around their ears. The Belgian town of Houffalize was particularly unlucky. Eisenhower had picked it as the place where the divided armies would join. U.S. forces pulverized Houffalize, trying to get the Germans out. On January 13th, Patton began his final assault. His men were chasing a sinking fox, he insisted, and babbling for the kill.
The German bulge, driven into the Allied lines, American lines, had a start line. And we were pushing them back toward that start line literally with two hands, one from the south and one from the north. And on the 16th at Houffalize, those two hands joined. So you had rejoined, you now had a solid American front, but it still had to go 10 or a dozen miles to win back to the German start line.
The day after Houffalize was taken, Patton congratulated his corps commanders on their victory at the Battle of the Bulge. But whatever the papers said, this fight was not over. It would take 2 weeks to go the last 10 miles. The men at the front were getting almost no replacements. Platoons of 40 had been ground down to 8 or 10. Still, the command ordered them to turn and fight their way east.
And so the fellows, there were a hell of a lot less of them, and they were in terrible shape. Boston guy McCarthy was suffering from both dysentery and upset stomach, and he was throwing up, he was working both ends, and he got awfully weak. And in one attack they went into, he was a sergeant, he passed out right in the middle of the attack. His guys took him over to a haystack, pulled it apart, put him in it, packed him down to keep him freezing, finished off the attack, and came back and got him later on. It was very tough. They wouldn't send him back. He tried to go back. Nothing sent you back, except big holes, or dead.
The first quality of a soldier, Napoleon said, is constancy in enduring fatigue and hardship. Courage is only second. In the final stages of the Battle of the Bulge, the men on both sides were spent. Their army's resources dwindled. All that was left was survival of the most primitive kind.
GIs crawled along a roadside.
The German troops were in tatters, but they kept fighting. If they tried to surrender, they'd likely be shot. German dead were left to freeze where they fell, past the point of pity. American soldiers sat on them like logs to eat their rations. On the 22nd of January, Patton called Bradley and urged that all armies attack, whether they were fatigued or had losses or not. Blood was so short that American field hospitals had to bleed healthy enlisted men. Penicillin was recycled from urine. The instructions to the doctors never changed. Throughout that fall and winter, they salvaged anyone they could and shipped them back to the front.
Captain Ben Kimmelman.
Men who were wounded and were redeemable were in a very bad position. There's a kind of a merciless rule about sending them back in if they're able to go. And as far as they could tell, it would be repeatedly if they weren't killed or so badly wounded that they were destroyed. It's very hard to forget the expressions in their faces. They have a kind of a hollow-eyed, lifeless, slack-jawed expression, and they almost don't see you as you go by. And you don't, after a while, you learn not to greet them because their minds are elsewhere. It's almost as though they're going to a hopeless doom. And there's a phrase for these men. They were called ragmen. These were infantrymen or infantry medics or such, going back up to a hopeless future or no future, and having no choice in the matter, determined, and their practiced march, their practiced step is, as always, back up where they must go.
It just looked almost endless, like you were going to be there the rest of your life. If you were wounded, you could be out of it for a while. At least that was time that you'd be back in the hospital and could warm up and get something to eat and be able to take a bath and that sort of thing. But then you knew that you had to go back up.
If you're lucky, it's going to be a leg wound. If you're not lucky, it'll be worse. And if you're very, very lucky, you'll take it through the head. Because after you're in combat a while, dying is a lot easier than living. A friend of mine, Ollie, and I fell into a depression in the ground, hardly qualified as a foxhole. We were both numb, absolutely numb with exhaustion. And all he could say for about 24 hours a day was, we gotta shoot ourselves. We gotta take a bullet to an arm or a leg or somewhere. We gotta get out of here because we're never gonna make it. He said, we're just never gonna make it. And what happened to me is my stomach started to curl up as if I was going to start to cry. And I was afraid I was cracking up. When the enemy's 500 yards away and you got support troops behind you and you're sitting there in a hole with a guy who wants to shoot himself and you're ready to cry, It's not normal. And the other fellows already cracked.
Black and white titles appear. War Department Film Bulletin, produced by the Army Pictorial Service of the Signal Corps. Psychiatric procedures in the combat area.
For every 4 men wounded, 1 soldier will become a psychiatric casualty. Such men may be shaking or crying, but more often they are just very tired and dirty and depressed. They are unnerved and have no initiative. They're not quitters, but are truly ill.
Tell me, soldier, what's your trouble?
I can't stand seeing people killed.
What were you afraid of?
Everything.
He looks at the ground.
What in particular?
The slouching, disheveled soldier heaves a sigh and stares at his feet.
What in particular?
Dead.
What?
Dead.
Dead what?
Dead people. I can't stand seeing them.
I can't hear you.
Can't stand seeing dead people.
What people who were not necessarily severely wounded, but who were no longer in charge of themselves. They would put them in a detachment or an installation to put them through a kind of a very quick and dirty process in which they were given sodium amytal or one of these other, it's a sort of a truth serum thing, but it was in the form of tablets. And this would give them a very deep, deep sleep, sort of almost a trance-like sleep, for 24, sometimes a 48 hours. During this time, the enlisted men and myself would sometimes go by. We had to supervise it because they'd be screaming and they would be deep, deep asleep and there'd be terrible expressions of their fear and their fright.
You're back on the battlefield now. Watch out, those shells are coming. Watch out! Duck!
The sleeping man flinches.
The assumptions were that this would have some kind of cathartic effect, the sodium amytal, which the men called blue 88s. You know, the most effective artillery piece of the Germans was the 88, and this was blue 88s, because the sodium amytal was a blue tablet. And then they would come out of this, and depending on the dosage, 24, 48, 72 hours, and they'd be walking around completely numb. Sometimes they would be slipping and falling. That took a few more hours. And then they would be given a shower, a new clothes, and a pep talk, and the attempt was made to send them back. I say the attempt because it didn't always succeed. They weren't suitable to be returned. And in a sense, the thing that repelled me so badly was that you were talking to men who weren't quite yet still in charge of themselves, and you were sort of shepherding them back to the front. At one time, the chief of staff asked me to go out and talk to them. He said, you're good at that, you go out and talk. And I said, Colonel, I really don't want to do it. He said, I know, Ben. He said, do it anyhow. And I went out and I tried haphazardly to try to get them, to persuade them to get in their trucks and go back. They'd finished with their 72 hours, they'd gotten their clothes, and they just looked at me, and half of them looked as if they couldn't focus. And finally, one of them said, don't you guys understand? If you can still walk and see, they'll keep shipping you back.
Ben Kimmelman's lips start to quiver. He looks down, squeezes his mouth shut, and composes himself.
So I didn't do that again. And I told my commanding officer I wouldn't.
He shakes his head and looks at the floor. Now, a photo of a long line of infantrymen hiking past trees heavy with new fallen snow.
In the last few days of January, American troops made their way back to the original lines, the ones they'd held before the German offensive began. The books on the Battle of the Bulge were closed. 16,000 Americans had been killed. 60,000 more wounded or captured. German casualties were said to be twice that.
An ice-covered body lies in a river.
There was no ceremony to mark the end of the battle, not even a headline. The the GIs simply kept moving forward into Germany.
The Battle of the Bulge would be remembered as the great surprise of the campaign in Europe. I think General Bradley would hold that it speeded the end of the war because the German took so many casualties, and when he was as severely defeated as he was in the Battle of the Bulge, it helped end the thing by May. An intelligence failure, certainly we didn't know he was coming. When you look back on the record now, you can say, hey, you should have seen this, or you should have seen that, or anticipated this. I don't think anyone did.
A light snowfall half buries a dead soldier. Townspeople return. In a stroller, a 2-year-old girl stares soberly at us. 2 children ride in a large basket, up to their chins in blankets. Curator of the Nuts Museum, Guy Franz-Arand.
When we started to make our way back into the Ardennes, it was something quite amazing. Emerging from the snow, the white, were 2 things. Houses that were destroyed, because the villages were practically all destroyed, and huge black holes, vast numbers of them, in the fields. It was an apocalyptic landscape. Really, a madman wouldn't have been able to imagine such a landscape.
Joseph Scheer.
Par exemple, on avait enterré les gens, mais très sommairement.
People had been buried, but very summarily, because in winter everything was frozen.
A rifle stuck in the ground marks a hump of snow.
It was frightening. And our parents, of course, tried to keep us from those places. Still, they were everywhere, these bodies half buried.
Près 2 ou 3 ans, on a fini par quand même.
It was 2 or 3 years before they managed to find the bodies of all the soldiers that had fallen.
3 simple wooden crosses stick out of a thick blanket of snow. A round American helmet lies beside one of the crosses. Now, a narrow road hemmed in on both sides by walls of tall, impenetrable, snow-covered pine trees.
Every time it snows or something, I'll think about those days during the Bulge. It brings back memories of the friends that I lost and the desperate feeling that we had in those days. And it kind of irks me that after 50 years, I still think that way. I should forget it and go on about my life, but I guess it made such an impression, it'll always be with me, I guess.
These memories are there a lot more vividly, even after 50 years, than probably what I did yesterday. I can tell you how deep the snow was. I can tell you the color of the snow and the blood the next morning. I know what equipment I had on. I know the words that we said. They stay with you.
In the present, the fields are divided by the same barbed wire fences.
It doesn't go away. It sleeps sometimes, but then it awakens again.
A photo of a soldier wearing a snow-encrusted face mask. One of his eyes is completely white.
Things are happening, people are doing things that you never dreamed you'd ever see or hear about.
Soldiers inch through a forest.
It's an enormity of an experience. And everything after that has been a footnote.
American soldiers carrying guns and ammo boxes trudge single file through the snow. A red sunset hangs above the rolling battlefields. Fade to black.
There's more about the Battle of the Bulge at American Experience Online. Browse an interactive timeline of the war and read personal stories from soldiers and nurses who were there. All this and more at PBS Online, pbs.org. America Online keyword, PBS. Battle of the Bulge is available for $19.95 plus shipping and handling from WGBH Boston Video. To place an order, call 1-800-255-9424.
I don't think any man can exactly explain combat. It's beyond words.
I don't really want to get to know anybody over here because it would be bad enough to lose a man. I damn sure don't want to lose a friend.
I love you so. And miss you so.
From the revolution, to the Gulf War. These are their words. War Letters. Next time on American Experience.
This program has been described by the Media Access Group at WGBH, described by John Krinke, read by Margo Stage. For more about description, call DBS at 1-800-333-1203 or visit our website, access.wgbh.org. Credits appear. Produced by Thomas Lennon, written by Thomas Lennon and Mark Zwanitzer, edited by Ken Aluto, narrated by David McCullough, music by Brian Keene. For American Experience, executive producer Margaret Drain. A Lennon Documentary Group film for American Experience. Copyright 2002, WGBH Educational Foundation. All rights reserved.
American Experience is made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of the role of technology. The foundation also seeks to portray the lives of the men and women engaged in scientific and technological pursuit.
Liberty Mutual Insurance is a proud supporter of the American Experience. And by helping people live safer, more secure lives, we're also proud supporters of the American Dream.
At The Scotts Company, we help make gardens more beautiful, lawns greener, trees taller. If there's a better business to be in, please let us know.
And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
This is PBS.